Addressing a Jehovah's Witness defense of the governing body. This is the JW Review. Recently, I posted a podcast, which was basically a lecture or a talk I gave on the Jehovah's Witness view of the governing body and whether it's biblical. And of course, I concluded that it's not biblical. It doesn't line up with what the scriptures teach about ecclesiastical authority. Well, since then, Rotherham, who is a Jehovah's Witness apologist, has responded with some points in trying to interact with my presentation. Now, I've had many, many discussions with Rotherham, so you can just look at past blog posts, and he's responded to almost every one of them, so you can kind of see what we've discussed and what topics. Now, we've had interactions on 1919 and the Faithful and Discreet Slave, but we haven't really delved into a whole lot of detail on the governing body, or at least going into the scriptures that Jehovah's Witnesses try to use to support the governing body. So this is a somewhat of a unique discussion for us. So what I'll do here, and this might end up being more than one podcast, but I'll go through his comment and just interact with them. So the first thing he says is, "You said, me, that Jehovah's Witnesses meet regularly and decrees what all Jehovah's Witnesses must believe in virtually every area of life." His response is, "Of course, this is an exaggeration to serve an agenda to say virtually every area of life. However, when it comes to biblical teachings and Christian morality, they rightfully have the ecclesial authority to make decisions and guidelines as it should be." Well, I don't really think it's an exaggeration any more than it is an exaggeration for me to say that the scriptures inform every area of my life. They give me guidelines for me to make on every single decision, to where I can say, is this decision sin or is it not? Does this decision glorify God or does it not? And I think that's pretty much every area of life. Now, it's silly to think that I'm saying that they're going to decide, the governing body is going to decide on what color socks you wear or what color tie you wear. Well, that's not obviously what I'm trying to say, but I still don't think it's an exaggeration. Now, Rotherham says that when it comes to biblical teachings and Christian morality, they rightfully have the ecclesial authority to make decisions and guidelines. So what I want to say is, prove it. Prove that the governing body has the authority to tell you what you must believe on Christian morality and doctrine, where you're obliged to obey it absolutely and unquestionably, and that goes for all Christians worldwide. Prove that they have the authority to do that. And what you're actually going to see in this whole correspondence is that Rotherham doesn't actually prove scripturally the governing body as an established ecclesial office to which all Christians worldwide are to obey. He doesn't actually prove that. All he does is try to poke some holes in my case, which doesn't in and of itself prove his case. Autonomy in such areas leads to religious anarchy and confusion and moral breakdown. Just look around in the churches today, and one should be able to see that in evidence of differing degrees. Now, what I would say to that is, even if that's true, that doesn't prove a governing body. And do the scriptures ever provide that, a governing body, as a solution for confusion and moral breakdown? Well, I would say that it doesn't. The examples in the scriptures might say, you know, look to the apostles and what they teach, or Paul saying, hey, look at what I'm teaching, this is the truth. Well, that's obviously because he was an inspired apostle. But in many cases, or most cases, they're actually saying to look at God, look to direction from the Holy Spirit, or look to the scriptures. They aren't saying look to the governing body when you're seeing confusion and moral breakdown around you. That's completely absent from the scriptures. Now, when it comes to autonomy, I provided for evidence for autonomy in my presentation, so I would recommend that you go back and listen to that for that evidence. But when I say autonomy, I need to qualify what I mean by that. So when I say autonomy, I don't mean that is devoid of the scriptures or the Holy Spirit or even guidance from those in authority like elders. I'm not saying that's what autonomy means. So what I'm saying is that in this context, that it's autonomy from an established governing body. And so for some examples, go back and look at my presentation. The examples that I provided from the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter to showing how they had autonomy from any kind of governing body. Now, it's not autonomy from God or independence from God, because obviously the Holy Spirit and direct guidelines from God were informing on their decisions. So I'm qualifying what I mean by autonomy. Furthermore, by autonomy, when it comes to the congregations, I'm talking about self-governance. So each congregation was run by elders to which the congregation members were subject to. And I think that's indisputable scripturally. But what's also indisputable is that following the death of the apostles, these congregations were not subject to any authority beyond their elders. There's just no evidence of that. Now, you see in the scriptures, if you read through Acts or you read through some of the epistles, of course the congregations were subject to the authority of the apostles. But where did the apostles provide any direction that upon their death, Christians would need to look to the authority of the governing body? It's completely absent. Rotherham continues, "To claim the Bible makes only one mention of a meeting is of no consequence as to how many times they actually met. There is simply no way to know." Now that's a really amazing admission. So if that's the case, then how can you prove a governing body that meets regularly and informs on pretty much every doctrinal and spiritual matter that Jehovah's Witnesses are to believe? So I'm willing to grant that there might have been other times when there was more than one apostle and an elder meeting to settle disputes. And why wouldn't they do that? But even so, that does not prove a governing body. So again, I have to ask, where is the evidence for this governing body? Rotherham continues, "The fact is, though, when they did meet with this meeting, they made decisions called decrees that became binding upon all congregations, not just a local one. In Acts 16:4, it tells us that Paul and the others, in a town-to-town fashion, delivered the decrees reached by the apostles and elders in Jerusalem for the people to obey." Well, of course these decrees were binding because these were apostles and their writings were inspired. They were the very words of God. So yeah, of course those decrees were obeyed. So while there indeed was a local dispute in Jerusalem, indeed it had been disputed in other areas according to Acts 15:23. So it was necessary for the letters to go to those areas so that the Christians there would know that this wasn't a teaching of the apostles. So yeah, it wasn't solely a local dispute, but it also was a local dispute. And once the apostles decided on what the truth was, well, other congregations who were involved in the controversy, well, they needed to know what the apostles were teaching on the matter. But again, that does not teach an established governing body. Rotherham continues, "There is no conclusive evidence that when the governing body convened, that it included the entire Jerusalem congregation. So when I bring all this stuff up about others being present in this Jerusalem council, it could have been the case that no one else was present but some elders and the apostles. Even then, that would not prove an established office of the governing body. However, I think there are some really good clues to show that what happened in that Jerusalem council does not parallel what happens in governing body meetings. So, even if it was true in what Rotherham said, who was and who was not a governing body member at the council? And how can we know? How can we know who was and wasn't a governing body member? Especially since nowhere in the scriptures does it tell us anything about who the governing body members were, what a governing body member is. All we have is this one example in the book of Acts where a meeting took place. So another question I have is, when did this governing body become a governing body, and was Paul a member? I mean, you might find some things in Watchtower magazines where it seems to suggest Paul might have been a member, but was Paul at that time a member or was he not? Now, if Paul was not a member at that time, well, that's really interesting because you have others coming into these governing body member meetings to decide on these matters. But you don't have that happening, as far as I know, in governing body member meetings today. Now, as we're going to see below, there is strong evidence that the Jerusalem church was indeed there and present, and at least had a part in some of the decisions that were made. So next, Rotherham says, the Pharisees who spoke up in favor of circumcision were evidently allowed to join the apostles and older men in order to settle the dispute. Since those Pharisees would represent the views of those promoting circumcision, it is logical that they would be joining the meeting with those who are being called upon to decide. Nothing indicates that the entire congregation was present. As verse 6 clearly states, it was just the apostles and older men of Jerusalem who are going to decide. Otherwise, why not mention everyone who was present? Now, it's an interesting admission by Rotherham that non-governing body members join the meeting. Now, if we're looking at Acts chapter 15 as the norm, since it's kind of the only example that we have, then would Rotherham also admit that non-governing body members also join the meetings today? What's also interesting is that the participation of the Pharisees and also the whole congregation, that actually complicates things if this is an established governing body, which I would say it's not. So first of all, how would we determine who is and who is not a governing body member? I mentioned that earlier. Is it simply due to the fact that the Pharisees aren't governing body members because they disagreed with the teaching of the apostles? So is that how we decide who is and who is not a governing body member? Well, I don't know, because the text doesn't tell us, and nowhere does it teach us who a governing body is and who they aren't and what the qualifications are. So it's just so interesting that the scriptures don't provide these details. So if that's the case, then what are we to say about Paul's disputes with Peter? Now consider Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 through 14. It says, but when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of circumcision. The rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, if you being a Jew live like the Gentiles and not like the Jews, how is it that you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews? So here we have Paul rather publicly having a dispute with Peter. So whether or not Paul was a governing body member, you don't see this kind of thing happening. you see apostles challenging one another. Or if we're going to put it in the context of the governing body, you would see governing body members challenging one another. So we have here examples of autonomy. This is just one other example that just would not apply to the Jehovah's Witness governing body today. So Rotherham continues, as far as the quote-unquote multitude goes, it does not in every context mean a great number of people, but as is revealed by Thayer's lexicon, it can simply mean the whole number, the whole multitude, the assemblage. At Acts 28:6, it is used in reference to a mere bundle of sticks gathered by Paul. So yes, there was an assemblage of men, apostles, older men, Paul, Barnabas, and some former Pharisees, and they all became silent when Paul and Barnabas began to speak. Well, first of all, it may be what Thayer claims, and I'm not going to dispute that. But if we take a wider lexical search, at least BDAG seems to be more in agreement with me. In fact, BDAG lists Acts chapter 15, verse 12 as, quote-unquote, the whole community and group. And the reason for this is simple. The context indicates in verse 22 that the whole church was present. So there's really no good reason to limit the meeting to only the apostles, the elders, and the Pharisees. So Rotherham continues, even though the congregation was apparently in on the decision as to who to send to Antioch, there's no reason to believe that they were also at the meeting where the decision was made. So first of all, there's no reason to doubt that they were there, the whole congregation. But even if they weren't there at the initial discussion on circumcision, they certainly were there in deciding on who to send, which it seems like Rotherham is admitting. So with that said, does the governing body today follow this as an example in terms of having more than just governing body members there in the meetings and also in making decisions? Well, the answer is no, the governing body, as far as I know, does not do that. So we're just seeing time and time again with this example, this text, where the parallels are just not adding up. We should note that in chapter 16, verses 4 through 5, it was the decrees decided upon by who? By the apostles and older men of Jerusalem. The final authority is spelled out to be the apostles and older men. And if this account was nothing more than a local issue involving a mere single autonomous congregation, why then were the decrees sent out to all the congregations for them to observe? That shows central authority. So I'm not saying that this was merely a local issue, and I was careful to qualify what I meant by that. What I said was Jerusalem was the location, or a major location, of the controversy. So Rotherham, again, is assuming an established office of a governing body when it's simply not there. Just because the apostles and some local elders decided on a matter which resulted in an inspired letter, that does not prove a governing body. But what it does prove is that the apostles were commissioned by Jesus Christ to declare inspired doctrine to which Christians were obliged to obey. And it could have been the case that the matter was decided by a single apostle, and it would have been just as authoritative. So in conclusion to all this, and that was all that Rotherham had to say on this matter in the post on my blog to the podcast. So none of this proves a governing body. If anything, maybe it pokes some holes in my case. Let's just grant him that it pokes some holes. Do we see any scriptural evidence of a governing body as the Jehovah's Witnesses see it? I don't think that it shows that at all. For more information about Jehovah's Witnesses and other topics, please visit michaeljfelker.com. There you can also reach me directly to submit questions or comments to be covered on the JW Review. To subscribe to this podcast, please go to iTunes and search for the JW Review.